animals, fish, and birds for the number of people involved. Following a per capita basis for equal distribution of animals, birds, and fish to an equal distribution of people is ridiculous and ignorant. Few non-native people eat Alaska animals, fish, and birds daily. I recognize no expert except my native elders who gives me the laws which I and my people uphold to the finest degree. Further, I ask that these experts in socioeconomic fields be disregarded unless they serve the actual users of Nikupak, real meat, birds, and fish, and give complete respect to the animals, and that the impact of that respect be considered at all times. We can't say how many animals we're going to kill. We can't set quotas. The animals hear us. This is something we really believe, we know. No need would be found to even dare to make game laws, fish laws, and bird laws on Alaska indigenous people. How dare anyone begin to believe that they have a right to impose laws, restrictions, and penalties on us when our sovereign system of government, laws, penalties, and restrictions have been in existence for over 1.5 million years. No, we still own Alaska. We still were not conquered by Russia, nor the United States, nor the state of Alaska. We are yet in control of our destiny, and we are yet the governments of Alaska. We still own all of the land within the original tribal boundaries, and we maintain the right to govern ourselves and any activity on our land, Alaska, that we own. We can again bring the banner of a previous AFN convention in 1977. Does one way of life have to die so that another can live? It may never grow old. So intent are the foreigners on regulating our subsistence lifestyles, hunting, fishing, in our existence. So intent are we to live in complete respect for the animals, fish, and birds, land, water, air, and fellow sovereign Alaska indigenous landowners, and consideration for indigenous sovereign people of the world. Thank you.
Thank you. What I suggest we do now is this. We've had a good discussion of a number of case studies where Native people are undertaking initiatives in the field of subsistence policy and management. We heard about the Hooper Bay Agreement, the Alaska Eskimo Whaling Commission, the International Porcupine Caribou Commission, the Eskimo Walrus Commission. We heard from the Council of Yukon Indians, and we heard about the COPE Agreement, and we heard from TCC, from Willie Goodwin about the steps being taken by IRAs in NANA, and from Weaver Ivanoff about the steps to assert jurisdiction over traditional tribal boundaries in his region. There were two more case studies, I shouldn't put it that way, but two more speakers we wanted to reach today. We haven't quite reached them. That is Harvey Fite to tell us something about the James Bay and Northern Quebec Agreement and its provisions for subsistence, and Dan Gross to talk about subsistence in the Third World. I was going to suggest that we spend another 10 minutes here this afternoon and invite Harvey Fite to sketch for us the most prominent features of the James Bay and Northern Quebec Agreement regarding subsistence, giving us something to think about overnight, and then we could return in the morning and allow Harvey to complete his presentation, then turn to Dan Gross. And then, having looked at those case studies, consider drawing back, so to speak, from them, consider what does it all mean. And I thought we would ask Joe Meeker and Dick Nelson, Peter Usher, and Gary Holtas to speak to that, and of course others, but I thought I would specifically call on them tomorrow. And I asked Dr. Mike Holloway to come tomorrow too, because I ran into him last night and he was telling me that he has practiced in the bush and he thinks that subsistence is important to physical and mental health of the people out there, and I was hoping we might have time to give him an opportunity to say something tomorrow. So with that program in mind, perhaps we might just give our attention for these last few minutes this afternoon to Harvey Fight. Harvey, if you have the energy to draw a microphone towards you.
Okay. I think what I'll do with 10 minutes is not really try and survey the agreement. I was going to try and pick out parts of the agreement that seem to relate to some themes. Rather than break up that part of it, maybe what I'll do is take the part of the agreement that's probably most unusual and just give a quick run through it, the income security program, leave that with people overnight, and then come back tomorrow with the other. The James Bay Agreement was negotiated in 1973 and 74, after the province of Quebec had announced that it was going to build the James Bay Hydroelectric Project, and after the Cree and Inuit people of northern Quebec had taken the province to court, won the first round of a court case, but felt that the court process was unable to stop the construction of the project for any significant amount of time, or found that it couldn't stop it for any significant amount of time. And they negotiated a land claims agreement or an Aboriginal rights agreement in order to try and assure the circumstances in which subsistence would be able to continue and in which they would be able to continue to have wildlife to use and to build their society and culture and economy on. I'll keep that very brief and say that a key part of their perception of the problems they faced, there were a range of problems they saw they faced. I'm talking again from my perception as someone who was involved in it, but I take responsibility. This is my perception of what was perceived and thought about and why things were done there, not a Cree perception. And but I'm the person you have here today. The problems they faced were many of the problems that are being talked about here, problems of conflicting use, problems of assuring rights to use resources, problems of assuring habitats and the future of the resources themselves. But one of the problems they saw they had that's been touched on a few times but not extensively discussed is the problem that their hunting depended on a large cash income or a steady cash income. That more and more they needed equipment in order to be able to go out and hunt, more and more they needed access to services that required cash, airplanes, et cetera, snowmobiles increasingly, and they found that their ability to go out hunting was being restricted by the difficulties of maintaining a cash income, given the limited job opportunities in their region, and given the fact that many of the job opportunities were of a kind that they didn't desire. There were a number of studies done documenting this cash shortage. In several communities, you could actually see you could actually count the number of people who weren't able to go out on the land as extensively as they wanted to. And so one of the things that they insisted be included in the agreement was a provision to assure the cash flow to individuals, the cash income that was needed by individuals in order to go out on the land and hunt. And what they set up was what's called the income security program for people who hunt, fish, and trap. It was only set up for the Cree. Only the Cree wanted it. The Inuit chose a different kind of a program based on making monies available in a global amount to each community, and I won't describe that in this time. Basically, the program, as the Cree designed it, was a program that paid individuals for each day they left the community to go out hunting, fishing, and trapping. And it gave the amounts are indexed to the cost of living in Canada or in Quebec. The most recent figures I have are from 1982-83. The program gives a per diem amount up to 8 months in the bush, in other words, 240 days. And it pays an amount in 1982-83 of $23.50, essentially, to the man and to his consort, to the head of the family and to his or her consort. So that there's about $50 a day coming in for each day spent hunting. There are also some calculations for families with large numbers of children that give them increased amounts over the basic per diem. What it, in 1982-83, the program came into effect in 1976. In 1982-83, it was providing a total cash income to families of about $9,000 average per family. Large families were getting up to about $21,000 a year. Small families were getting around $5,000 or $6,000. That meant that total, if you tried to give a, it's very hard to calculate what that means, but the average expenditure from the best data that's available would have been about $7,000 of that would have been spent on hunting equipment, hunting transportation, outfitting, and about $4,000 would have been other disposable income. In addition to the program income, people would have had family allowance payments, social security payments, et cetera, that come in to everyone. And they also have the products of their harvest and of their labor. I can't describe the details. The program was costing, in 1982-83, about $1 million a year, about $10 million a year for a population of about 6,000 people. Of the 6,000 people, about half of them, about 3,000, were beneficiaries of the agreement. That is, they were in the families that were hunting sufficiently in order to benefit. People had to spend at least 3 months of the year out on the land hunting in order to qualify. That's the main qualification. There's a more complex set, but I'll skip that. I can answer those in questions if people want. To give you a quick idea of what the impacts of the program were, it demonstrated that cash had really seriously constrained people's ability to hunt. The year it was implemented in 1976, people were able to join the program by saying that they wanted to go back to hunting as well as by saying that they had been hunting in the years previously. And in the first year, 700 families or individuals joined the program by saying that they had been hunting continuously. And an additional 200 people joined the program and stayed on it, as saying that they were people who wanted to go back to hunting now that there was sufficient cash to permit them to pursue the activity. So that it increased the number of people who are actively hunting by about a quarter. Since then, in 1982-83, the program stayed steady at about 900 families until 1982-83, when it jumped from 900 to 1,100, which is another almost 25% increase. That increase was due in part to the closing down of several community projects and in part to the impact of the recession in the region. And again, it was an interesting demonstration of what Native people and the Cree people had always been saying, which was that subsistence was the primary economy for their region. It was the one they could count on. When jobs weren't available, it was to the land that they would turn. And indeed, given the ability to use cash resources to go back to the land within a very short time, when the recession hit, people did do precisely that. It also increased not only the number of people, it increased the amount of time people spent hunting or out in the bush. The number of days people spent on average rose by about 25% the first year. People average almost 8 months on the land, out of the settlements, in bush camps. And over the 6 or 7 years that we have data following its introduction, the amount of time spent out hunting has increased by a further 10%. Some of the effects of it have been to, the Cree found that the shortage of cash was disrupting the social pattern of hunting, and they wanted this program to stop the erosion of traditional social patterns. For example, people found that they didn't have enough to take their family and their children out hunting, so the men were starting to go out hunting by themselves in men's only camps. The program was designed by the Cree to pay a sum to both the husband and wife to encourage families to go to the bush together. And it did precisely that. It increased the number of families going in the bush, and it increased the number of children that families took with them in the bush. And it's put a tremendous pressure on the school system, which the Cree have some have a board that runs under their own control, to adjust its school year to permit children to spend as much time as possible with their families in the bush. It's created some new social forms. It's created a trappers' committees in each village, which are really committees in which the senior hunters get together and decide many of the complex decisions, because with more people going out on the land, I'll have to explain tomorrow, there's a hunting territory system, but it means that the men who are the senior hunters have much more complex decisions about who should go where and how much can be caught, because there's many more people and there's much more time to spend hunting. Some of the interesting effects have been also that it hasn't taken people out of jobs. People still seek employment in the summer to supplement their income, but what it's done is it's given them greater choice and made them more selective about jobs. What we found in a study has been that people do not leave the village extensively for employment anymore. That is, hunting, people who are spending their winters hunting, do not tend to go out of the village for employment. If employment is available in the village, working in Cree groups in the Cree language, people seek and take that opportunity to work. But if they have to go to work outside the village in social settings that are not highly desired in their view, then people don't take the employment, so that people have become more selective about the kinds of employment they're prepared to enter into. It's also led to, it's not increased the harvest of game. Interestingly, the first year, there were substantial takes of big game, but after that, the total harvest of game remained surprisingly steady, despite more people on the land and despite more time spent in the bush. The key resources, the big game resources that are very intensively used, were not overused. What happened is that people spent the time to harvest resources, game like rabbits and partridge, that it takes a lot more time to catch. It takes a lot more work to catch, but there are many more of them when their cycle is up. And so people spend time catching more of the small game that could carry the burden of more intensive hunting. And the social distribution networks in the village were also extended. People kept exchanging the product of the harvest widely in the village, and in fact more extensively than they had been able to in the past. Let me see if I can just hit any other high points. I think the other key point is that there was greater confidence in the future of hunting. Many more people said that they would encourage and take their children to the bush more now because they thought there was a future to it, and they were more sure there was a future to it. And the number of young people entering hunting has certainly been enough to replace those who are retiring from it. And with the jump in the last 1982-83, we don't know the impact, but it looks like those who came in and the 200 who came in more in addition in 1982-83 are primarily young people, so that hunting may not only be holding its own now instead of declining in participation, it may actually be increasing substantially. That's the basic idea.
Thank you, Harvey. I'm glad, very glad we turned to you before departing, because that's one of the most fascinating case studies, I think, that we've put under glass here the last 3 days, and raises a whole lot of interesting questions about subsistence and its future. Maybe I could just ask you one question before we depart. The money for the income program for the hunters, was that negotiated by the Cree as part of the land claim settlement, and where does the money come from?
Right. The program is administered by a separate board made up equally of Cree and government appointees. The provincial government is obliged to pay to the board the funds that are necessary to run the board and run the program. The one qualification on it is that there's an upper limit on the size of the number of man days that have to be paid. So the province has some assurance that the program won't cost more than a certain amount every year. In fact, the number of people participating and the length of time they're in the bush, the program has exceeded that limit twice, and the limit has been revised upward through new negotiations. in a recognition by both the Cree and the government that its benefits have been positive and that it's a program that should be maintained and expanded. But they haven't been easy negotiations despite that agreement.
Yes, and well, thank you, Harvey. On that note, we will take our leave, and I hope that as many of you as can will be back tomorrow. You've been awfully good. We've had a very fine attendance thus far, and I hope we'll be able to start at 9 in the morning and carry on as long as we feel the urge. And if any of you have to leave tonight, I just want to express my thanks to you for coming and to say that there will be a record of the proceedings that will be sent to you, and we will do our best to get that out to you, but don't expect it for a while. Carry what you've learned around in your heads for the time being. Yeah. Well, yeah, I think if just about everybody has, but the guys I named, some of them haven't.